This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Terry Gross. My guest is David Sedaris. He has a new collection of personal essays called Calypso. As many of his fans know, he's very funny and he writes about very personal subjects, sometimes the kind of subject bound to make readers uncomfortable, like having an intestinal virus, worrying about needing the bathroom while traveling on a book tour, and having to be on stage. Alongside his essays in which he describes getting older and how his Fitbit has affected his OCD, he writes about his late mother's alcoholism and his sister's suicide. After he became famous, he moved from New York to Paris. Now he lives in West Sussex, England, where one of his obsessions is picking up trash from the road, miles of countryside road. It led to a trash truck being named in his honor and to his invitation to Buckingham Palace, where he was honored as a do-gooder. Earlier this month, he received a major literary honor, the American Academy of Arts and Letters Medal for Spoken Language. He's been a regular contributor to This American Life. Now that he lives in England, he's become a contributor to BBC Radio 4. Several essays in Calypso, his new book, were originally published in The New Yorker. David Sedaris, so good to talk with you again. So I want you to do a few short readings from your book, but I want you to start with the very first sentence from the very first essay.
Though there's an industry built on telling you otherwise, there are few real joys to middle age.
Okay, so I'm going to mention your age. You're 61. What are some of the things you are not enjoying about getting older?
Well, I feel like if I robbed a bank, this would be the perfect time to do it. Because when the police said, what did he look like? They'd say, he had gray hair. That's all people see after you're a certain age, is that you have gray hair. So that's part of it. And then part of it is just general achiness. But then part of it, too, is I feel like, you know, when all those young people took to the streets against gun violence, I wasn't jealous of them, but I just felt kind of happy for them. You know that time in your life when you're young like that and you really believe that you can make a difference? I'm not saying that you can't make a difference when you're older or that a person can't make a difference. There was just a light coming from inside of them. You know, like they were like lanterns kind of glowing with their certainty. And you lose that as you get older. And I had it when I was young, so it's not like I had a chance to have it and then I didn't. That's when you're bitter, when you think, gosh darn it, you know, I didn't take advantage of that when I had it. I did. I guess when you get further away from it, it makes you sad, I suppose.
Wisdom is supposed to come with advanced age, but I wonder if it doesn't drive us deeper into the groove of bad habits instead. So what's the balance been like for you between feeling like you're learning more as you get older and are becoming wiser versus feeling like all the bad things are just getting more bad?
Well, I'm giving a commencement address in a few days. Mm-hmm. And so I tried to put my wisdom down on paper and I thought, okay, what have I learned? And it was really kind of sad because one of the things I've learned is you really need to be careful about scented candles. You know, that was like one of my hard-earned bits of wisdom. Another one was to always have a joke tucked in your back pocket. Because I had to accept an award about 2 months ago, and I got there, and they said, are you going to read your speech, or do you have it memorized? And I said, speech? And they said, yeah. And then I'm looking out into this room, and there are all these, you know, it's all of literary New York in this room. And I reached into my back pocket, you know, into my memory, really, and pulled out the filthiest joke that I had at my disposal. And I got on stage, and I told it, and I thought, wow, that's really good advice to have for people, is to keep a good joke in their back pocket.
I wish I could ask you to tell that filthy joke, but for obvious reasons, I can't.
I know, and it's so good.
Oh.
But I just made a list, and I thought, well, what do I know? What has this advanced age gotten me? And it wasn't much, really, and you know, in terms of wisdom, but you know, I might have said this to you before, I'm not looking for sympathy. I'm not the smartest person. I'm rarely the smartest person in the room. You know, I have other qualities, but searing intelligence is not one of them.
We've spoken about your OCD before, and how it affects your constant cleaning, both of your home and also the cleaning of the road in the British countryside where you live. How has getting older affected that? Is that getting any? Is it staying the same? Is it being expressed in different ways?
Well, when I was young, like any kind of OCD thing, I would think, oh, what's next? Because I would go from making little noises in my throat, like, and you're in class and you're making little noises like that and you can't stop doing it. Then to jerking my head or rolling my eyes back. And then I was able to kind of harness it in a way, you know, like the picking up trash, right? I don't know. I do it anywhere, depending on the season, from 4 to 8 hours a day.
Eight?
But
wow.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I go out now. I go out again after dinner, and I'll go out, I don't know, 11 o'clock at night for another 2-3 hours, and I wear a headlamp. You know, any kind of device you wear on your head just makes you crazier, and so I wear a headlamp because it frees up my hands so I can have my bag and I can have my litter picker, and I'm out there on busy roads after midnight because there's not as much traffic. But that, to me, that's harnessing it for the good,
mm-hmm.
right? And it can be exciting to me because I don't know what's next. You know, something else could come along.
Like what new compulsion
is next?
6 months
from now. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, for a while it was feeding spiders. And I knew, and I know by a feeling I get in my chest, and I think, okay, I'm out of control, right? I'm obsessed and I'm out of control. And there's a kind of an excitement that I feel. And maybe it's what manic people feel when they're high. You know, it's not exuberance. It's tempered with something. You're not in the driver's seat anymore. Something else is pushing you forward and you can't stop. But, like I said, it's not like you can't stop jabbing a butter knife into a light socket. Right? You're feeding spiders, which, you know, that's making them happy, or you're picking up rubbish, or you're, I don't know what could be around the corner, but it's sort of exciting. I mean, that it never stops. It's not like that doesn't retire. That part of my brain doesn't say, okay, it's retirement age. I'm turning off now.
Does that part of your brain ever turn against you into anxiety and obsession about your body, physical ailments, your future, any of the things that plague us?
You know what? I think the iPod has saved me from so much of that, because if I'm alone with my own thoughts, then my thoughts can kind of churn like that. But now I listen to audiobooks and podcasts, and so I don't have to be alone with my thoughts anymore. I can think about other things. And that's really freed me up a lot.
So as long as your brain has something worthy to focus on, you're okay.
Yeah. But I feel bad for people like, you know, in the Middle Ages or something who didn't have, I guess you don't have to go back that far. You know, you can just go back to like the 1970s, really.
So you kind of referred to this in the book, but, you know, your mother died when she was 62, the age that you're going to reach in December. So how do you see her age differently than you did when she died?
It's interesting to me how much older people used to seem than they seem now. Like my Greek grandmother is maybe 80 when she died. But now I know 80-year-olds, and I'm friends with 80-year-olds, and they wear sneakers, right? And my grandmother had hair to her waist that she wore in a braid that she turned into a bun, and she had wire-rimmed glasses. Like if you looked at in the dictionary under old lady or under hag, you would find a picture of her. So now it doesn't seem that old to me now. But my mother died when she was 62 years old, and that seemed, I mean, it didn't seem, I knew she was young, but I think one thing with my mom is because she she smoked so much and she didn't get a lot of exercise that walking up the driveway would wear her out, really. And so that was something that made her older, I believe, than 61. I mean, just her physical limitations. Mm-hmm. I think if my mother had lived another 10 years, she would have had to have a Dragon oxygen tank behind
right,
her.
Right. You gave up smoking, right?
Yeah, I quit. I quit in 2008. I quit, and I never had another cigarette.
You just decided to quit and did? You say in the book you're good at quitting things when you need to.
I am. I am pretty good at it. So I quit drinking, and then I just quit, and then I quit smoking, and I just quit. But quitting eating is a little bit harder. I don't need to quit. I just need to quit eating for like 10 pounds. But that's everybody's story, really.
Boy, the last time I saw you, you did not need to lose any weight.
Well, now I've gone from being an envelope to a padded envelope. And I was complaining about it to a friend of mine recently. And I said, my shirt's no longer fit. And he said, call me when your socks no longer fit. It's true. He gained all of his weight from his knees down. And his socks don't fit him anymore.
Oh, that might be edema. That might be swelling as opposed to, like, food weight.
Well, made me feel good.
So I want you to do another short reading from the book. And this is about when you have guests coming over to visit, what it's like for your relationship with your partner, Hugh, when there's somebody else there observing you both.
Guests usually take the train from London. And before we pick them up at the station, I remind Hugh that for the duration of their visit, he and I will be playing the role of a perfect couple. This means no bickering and no contradicting each other. If I am seated at the kitchen table and he is standing behind me, he is to place a hand on my shoulder right on the spot where a parrot would perch if I were a pirate instead of the ideal boyfriend. When I tell a story he has heard so often he could lip-sync it, he is to pretend to be hearing it for the first time and to be appreciating it as much or more than our guests are. I'm to do the same, and to feign delight when he serves something I hate, like fish with little bones in it. I really blew this a few years back when his friend Sue came for the night and he poached what might as well have been a hairbrush.
Okay. I think I understand that need to, like, not disagree or quarrel in front of anybody else. What is it about that makes you so uncomfortable, to show that you disagree with you on something or he disagrees with you on something, or that you're not laughing at his joke or appreciating his story or vice versa, he's not appreciating yours?
I've been around other couples when they're bickering and it just looks so bad. And you leave and you think, oh my God, that's what their marriage is like? That's what their relationship is like? And so I don't want people to leave the house knowing the truth. I want them thinking. There's a writer, a fiction writer named Rick Bass, a short story writer, who came to our house in England a while ago. He was traveling around the world and he was cooking dinners for different writers. And so he came to England with his daughter and a friend, and he wrote about it, and he didn't miss anything, this guy. Like, Hugh and I would exchange a look, and he said, Hugh looked at David as if to say, what are these people doing here? And it's exactly what Hugh's look was. And I looked back at him like, we'll get into this later. And it was good to read because it reminded me that you're not. It's all right there for an observant person to see. I don't think that we bicker or argue more than most people. It's just, sometimes you're around somebody and you're comfortable with them and you let that show, and afterwards, I pull Hugh aside and I say, that cannot happen again.
What's his reaction when you say that?
You know what Hugh always does when you put him on the spot for something like that? Well, I am who I am and I can't hide it. And it's like, well, you need to learn to. Because we all need to learn to hide who we are.
Well, that sounds like great advice.
Be yourself.
But do you think having other people around can change how you relate to your partner?
I mean, I think because you've got an audience and you're having to be kinder to each other, and sometimes it makes you hear that person. I mean, because sometimes Hugh doesn't really hear what I have to say if it's just Hugh and I sitting around talking. He doesn't hear what I'm saying. That's a secret to being in a long relationship. And so, you know, I think it's important to pretend to listen, you know, to at least look like you're listening. But I don't think that you really have to, after a certain point, I don't think it's fair of me to expect you to listen after 26 years.
So, you know, I've been referring to Hugh as your partner because I can't remember if you're married or not. You have an essay about your accountant telling you that once there was marriage equality in England that you really needed to get married for tax reasons and also for estate reasons, like if one of you dies. But it's not concluded at the end. You ask him to marry you 18 times and he declines, but I don't remember if you actually get married or not.
No, we're not married. I wanted gay marriage to become legal, and then I wanted nobody to act on it. I thought that would have been perfect. To get the right and then to say, you know what, we don't want that. I mean, we want the right to do it. We want the right not to do it. That's what I want. I want the right not to do it. Plus, I just always feel weird when somebody says, this is my husband, Hugh. I don't know. I just think, ugh, when somebody says that to me.
Well, what do you call him? Your partner, your boyfriend, your lover?
I like boyfriend.
Uh-huh.
I like boyfriend, I'll take boyfriend to my grave. I really will. And when people say, well, he's kind of too old to be a boyfriend, I think, well, if you're not too old to wear shorts, you're not too old to be a boyfriend, I think.
Well, here's something. In a society, and I don't know how it is in England, but certainly in the U.S., there's a lot of benefits that you only get if you're married. You can only get the person on your health insurance if you're married. There are certain hospital visiting privileges you only get if you are immediate family, i.e. married, and the aforementioned like tax and estate issues. And the whole marriage equality Supreme Court case was based on estate issues and all the inequalities when you've been in a relationship for a long time and it's not in the eyes of the law like a legit, you know, relationship. So why not just sign up so you get those advantages?
Well, I guess that's the thing, because then you can always think, well, I will do it, you know, and you just don't do it, but you think I will do it. But as far as the hospital visits go, I saw somebody yesterday and his husband died horribly. They'd been together for a long time and died horribly for the last 18 months. And I always say to Hugh, like, I would love to be forbidden to visit you in the hospital. Like, if he gets like that. I just want to wash my hands of him. I really do. I've said that to him so in the very beginning. Like when you get sick or something, or you're in a wheelchair, you are on your own. I just want you to know that. And you were free to abandon me too.
Is that because you're afraid to see someone you care about suffering? Or it's just too much of a burden for you?
I mean, to tell you the truth, like we have a neighbor in England and her husband got dementia. And I couldn't believe how long she kept him at home. And that is not an easy thing to do. You know, when you think about the things that, you know, that really involves. I mean, I was so in awe of how she cared for him at the end. And I think it's easier to imagine our deaths than it is our decrepitude. You know, to imagine, like, our serious old age. I just don't think we're able to wrap our minds around that.
Well, I certainly think that decrepitude is way more frightening than death is, and for me.
Yeah. I couldn't bear to see Hugh. I just couldn't bear to see him, you know, with dementia or Alzheimer's or suffering in a horrible way. And so for somebody to say, well, I'm sorry, it's against the law for you to see it, I I'd say, okay. I would say, I don't want to see it.
So before we have to end, I want you to read one more short passage from your new collection, Calypso. And this is in response to a difficult question your boyfriend Hugh has asked you, which is, well, I'll let you read the question.
Why do you choose to remember the negative rather than the positive? I don't, I insist, thinking I will never forget you're giving me such a hard time over this. Honestly, though, does choice even come into it? Is it my fault that the good times fade to nothing while the bad ones burn forever bright? Memory aside, the negative just makes for a better story. The plane was delayed. An infection set in. Outlaws arrived and reduced the schoolhouse to ashes. Happiness is harder to put into words. It's also harder to source, much more mysterious than anger or sorrow, which come to me promptly whenever I summon them and remain long after I've begged them to leave.
And is that true for you as a writer, that in your diary do you focus on the negative more than the positive?
In my diary, I mean, nothing makes me more self-conscious writing in my diary than if I'm writing about something good, right? Like, if I'm writing about a nice thing that somebody said to me or an achievement, right? I just think, God, if anyone were to find this diary, I would look so bad congratulating myself here. Whereas if I'm complaining about something, I don't think twice about it. So I guess I usually lead with the not the complaint so much as just the, No, I'm going to take that back. I mean, if I see something, I'm more apt to write about bad behavior I witness than good behavior I witness. But I really hope I don't complain too much. But Hugh and I had a house guest a while ago, and she said, "Oh, my God, do you two ever stop complaining?" And I was shocked, and I just thought, we don't complain. And then we complained about her saying that. But I thought that's really something to watch, because you don't want to be that person who's just complaining about everything all the time, you know? I don't think I'm a Pollyanna, but I don't want to bring everybody down all the time, you know? So I try to lift things up a little bit with, looking at the bright side of something that happened.
Well, David, it's really been great to talk with you again. I'm so glad we did this. Thank you for coming back to the show, and good luck with the new collection.
Oh, thanks a million, Terry. Thanks for having me back on.
David Sedaris has a new collection of personal essays called Calypso. Our book critic, Maureen Corrigan, has a review of Stephen McCauley's new novel called My Ex-Life. Three of McCauley's seven novels have been made into movies. His previous novel came out 8 years ago, and Maureen says that was too long to wait. Here's her review.
I didn't know how much I needed a laugh until I began reading Stephen McCauley's new novel, My Ex-Life. This is the kind of witty, sparkling, sharp novel for which the verb chortle was invented. I found myself chortling out loud at so many scenes, I even took screenshots of certain pages and began texting them to friends. Some of those friends texted back, "Love this," or "Send more, quick," to which I replied, "Support the arts, buy the book." Let's leave the transcript of my text conversations there. The point is, My Ex-Life is a smart comedy of manners about Macaulay's signature subject, namely the disconnect between erotic desire and intimacy and the screwball paths that people take on the way to finally arriving home. As he did in his 1987 debut novel, The Object of My Affection, which was made into a movie with Jennifer Aniston and Paul Rudd, Macaulay focuses his story on two main characters, a man and a woman, soulmates who don't click sexually. Julie Fiske has now entered that phase of life where, we're told, her face had acquired that yesterday's dessert look common to the late middle-aged. Julie's husband has recently left her, and her teenage daughter, Mandy, suffers from a lack of affect and ambition. Determined to raise enough money to buy her ex's half of the charming, rickety Victorian house they once shared on the seacoast north of Boston, Julie has been renting out rooms on Airbnb, a source of much comedy here. But her ex-husband has been getting antsy about the money and their daughter's slacker behavior. That's where Julie's first ex-husband, our other main character, comes in. David Hedges lives in San Francisco and is self-employed as a pricey, independent, full-service college counselor, which means he reads a lot of college application essays, about 99% of which, we're told, start off with mention of a grandparent and/or cancer. David has just been dumped by his longtime lover. Back when he was young and married to Julie, David wasn't quite sure of his sexuality. When he became sure, their brief marriage ended. Now, out of the blue, the phone rings. It's Julie, whom David hasn't talked to in almost 30 years. After an awkward catch-up, she asks if David would give Mandy some guidance about the college application process. Turns out, he's happy to do more than that. Binge eating because of his breakup, drained from years of dealing with helicopter parents, and terrified that the carriage house he rents in San Francisco is about to be sold, David decides to deal with his problems by escaping from them. He catches a flight to the East Coast and settles into Fawlty Towers for a while with Julie and Mandy. Hilarity and mayhem ensue, but what helps make my ex-life so striking is Macaulay's droll precision with language. David's insights into the college application industry are reason enough to savor this novel. Take this gem, courtesy of Macaulay's omniscient narrator. David thought of his true mission as helping his teenaged clients gain a realistic understanding of who they were and what they could achieve in life once they stepped away from their parents' self-aggrandizing fantasies of them. Their parents had been so insistent about instilling self-esteem, they'd fallen into the trap of telling their kids they could do anything. Unfortunately, almost everyone interprets doing anything as doing the same three or four glamorous and impressive things: going to Harvard, retiring before ever working, giving an Oscar acceptance speech, and becoming the next Mark Zuckerberg, except hot. I said a moment ago that Macaulay's droll way with words is the element that makes this novel special, but it's more than that. His social satire is suffused with generosity, an awareness that most of us are destined to make colossal mistakes out of the best of motives. By the end of this story, as Julie and David revisit their own original blunder of a marriage, Macaulay summons up a conclusion that makes a profound statement about time passing and the shifting mirage of life goals. Like the best of comic fiction writers, I'm thinking in particular of the immortal Laurie Colwin. Macaulay draws his readers into reflecting on some of the big questions: sexuality, mortality, failure, with the lure of laughter.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed My Ex-Life by Stephen Macaulay. Coming up, we'll talk with former Vogue creative director and America's Next Top Model judge, Andre Leon Talley. This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Andre Leon Talley, is famous in the fashion world and beyond. He spent much of his career at Vogue magazine, becoming the fashion news director in 1983 and creative director in 1988. From 1998 to 2013, he was editor-at-large. He's a large man who covers himself in capes and caftans made for him by some of the world's top designers. He has an outsized personality, too. Now in his mid-60s, he looks back on his life in the new documentary, The Gospel According to Andre. He grew up in Durham, North Carolina, in the Jim Crow era. His grandmother, who raised him, was a maid for the men's dorms at Duke University. The fashions he was exposed to as a child came largely from what people wore to church on Sundays, until he discovered Vogue magazine. Reading Vogue was considered a most unusual preoccupation for a 9-year-old boy. After getting a scholarship to Brown University and a master's degree in French literature, he moved to New York, worked at Andy Warhol's magazine Interview, and was mentored by former Vogue editor Diana Vreeland when she was a consultant to the Costume Institute at the Metropolitan Museum of Art. Andre Leon Talley, welcome to Fresh Air. Let's start with, how were you introduced to the world of fashion?
Well, from an early age, I discovered fashion through the pages of Vogue. I went to the public library in Durham, North Carolina, and I was about 10 years old, or maybe 9, and I discovered this magazine called Vogue. And in those days, it came out on the 1st and the 15th of every month, and the editor was Diana Vreeland. And this was my escape world. When I was a young boy, I grew up in my grandmother's home in Durham, North Carolina, a modest home. She was a maid at Duke University. And it was just my grandmother and myself. She was an extraordinary woman. She was a frugal woman. And she watched her budget. She had a bank account. And we had a wonderful life because I never knew anything but love, unconditional love.
So you're a 9-year-old boy, and you're totally fascinated by these fashions that adult women are wearing. So what captivated you as a 9-year-old boy about the world of Vogue?
The world of Vogue meant more to me than what the women were wearing as models. The issues of Vogue captivated me not only before the images of the fashion spreads, but it was the magazine itself that turned me onto a world that I did not know or had not been exposed to. It was the world of literature, what was happening in the world of art, what was happening in the world of entertainment. It was my gateway to the world outside of Durham, North Carolina. It wasn't just the fashions. Of course, I love the fashions. I love the beautiful images, and I related so much to the images and then the written words, the captions, the articles. So I was living through Vogue as an escape hatch, but reading every single page, loving every single detail. I mean, they had a men's column called Men in Vogue, and that was very fascinating to me. Then Maxime de la Falaise had a cooking column. That was fascinating to me. And then, of course, the main spreads, they were all orchestrated by the great editor, Diana Vreeland, and they were basically built on her fantasy, but she just gave me the world. I discovered Truman Capote. I discovered the great ballerinas from the Bolshoi, who defected to the West. I discovered Nureyev in the Avedon photos. Nureyev was nude, photographed by Richard Avedon. All of this was just very exciting to me. And it was a world that I internalized and I kept to myself as a young man because no one was interested in Vogue or fashion other than I. And I was ripping pages out of Vogue, putting the pictures up on my wall in my room with thumbtacks. And I just had a room wallpapered from head to ceiling, floor to ceiling, with images from Vogue.
So were you bullied when you were in high school?
Of course I was bullied. I was bullied and beaten up and everything.
What was your defense?
I would get on the school bus, and I would say something, and they would just pounce on me. Because also, I had beautiful clothes. I didn't have a lot of clothes, but my grandmother and my father would put me in the best clothes they could afford, and I had beautiful sweaters and trousers and beautiful penny loafers and quality shoes, and I didn't show off. I wasn't a show-off. I wasn't showing off. But I would just get on the school bus, and I was tall and skinny, and they just would beat me up.
Okay, wow. So I want to kind of collapse a period of your life here. So you
collapse it, Dolly. Yeah,
collapse. So after you graduate high school, you go to college. Then
yes.
you move to Rhode Island to go to Brown University for your master's.
Yes.
Your undergraduate
yes.
and master's degree, both in French literature.
I got my undergraduate degree in French literature. And mm-hmm. I tell you, when I went to Brown and won that scholarship, the world opened. It was the first time ever being away from home. So I went to Brown alone. I went to the campus alone. I navigated my way alone. And I got to Brown and the world opened up. The world of exposure, the world of literature, I discovered even more. The great, great poets, Baudelaire, Rimbaud. I discovered the beautiful paintings of Eugène Delacroix. I discovered Manet. I discovered the great worlds of art, music had not been, classical music had not been a part of my upbringing. gospel music and church music. And in the world of Brown, I discovered beautiful classical music, piano music, Chopin, the Clara Schumann, things like this were really new to me. And I was so curious about everything. And the people were so sophisticated at Brown and at RISD, the Rhode Island School of Design. So I just had the world open up to me in just ways that had never been open to me before.
You know what? I realize you are one of the few guests I've had who talks even faster than I do.
I'm talking fast, but I'm loving it. I hope you understand it.
I absolutely understand, and I'm quite enjoying it. So you get to New York after graduating from Brown, mm-hmm. and you'd always wanted to meet Andy Warhol and the people who he helped make famous. And you not only got to meet them, you got to work at his magazine, Interview Magazine, which I should say parenthetically just filed for bankruptcy.
And closed.
And closed, yeah.
So, and folded.
So when you were there and got to see all of the, like, Warhol superstars and everything, mm-hmm. what made the biggest impression on you in terms of your own life, in terms of your own personal and professional identity? Because you were, you know, you were in your early 20s, I imagine, at the time, and it's a very formative period when you're still, you know, shaping who you are and figuring out who you want to be. And you're looking at all these people who kind of remade themselves, who transformed themselves into something else.
I loved it. I loved the world. Now, the people that I met through Warhol were the people that I always wanted to know. They were not bullies. They did not judge you. There was unconditional admiration, if not love. People were free. People had made their choices. People were different. You know, some people perhaps had better clothes than others, but everyone was noted for their own worth, their own gifts. And I think that's why I felt so good, because I felt at home. I felt that I was part of a special club at Andy Warhol's Interview Magazine. And they embraced me, and there was no criticism of me as it would have been at home in Durham, North Carolina. You know, I was brought up in a very strict, modest home, but the nucleus of my family was church. So being a black man brought up in the African-American Missionary Baptist Church culture meant that I had certain rules and certain ways to deport myself through clothes, and not only through my actions or attitudes about life. But when I got to meet Andy Warhol, and people were walking around in jeans and blazers and sometimes Rive Gauche and sometimes not Rive Gauche, the world came through the doors of the factory in Andy Warhol. Interview was the gateway to the world for me.
Well, another thing about the Andy Warhol crowd is that there was a lot of gender and sexual fluidity.
Gender and sexual fluidity, but it wasn't rampant and it wasn't overt. You had a certain culture of the office and the factory, which was very correct, very traditional, yet very relaxed and casual. There were all kinds of people. There were lesbians, there were gays, there were straight, there were drag queens, there were artists. But everyone was equal. So everyone mattered, and no matter who you were, it mattered. You mattered because you had individual gifts and talents, and that's what Andy admired. Now, there wasn't a lot of sexuality going on. I did not see people having sex rampantly at work or taking drugs, because it wasn't that atmosphere. When I got to the factory, it was long after Andy had an assassination attempt. So the rules changed. So people were chosen for their seriousness and chosen for their possibilities to become who they wanted to be. And I was allowed to become who I wanted to be at the factory and with Andy Warhol.
Right. So eventually you get to Vogue. You were a man at Vogue. You were also an African-American man at Vogue.
Yes.
So I'm sure you stood out. Did you feel like you were with your people,
felt,
or did you
I
feel like
felt
you were
bullied.
Separate?
I felt mm-hmm. that I was on top of the world. I felt that I was with the best people. After all, Vreeland had endorsed me. I had the full endorsement. It was like if you had a political endorsement. It was the full endorsement of Vreeland and Andy Warhol, who were, for me, the king and queen of New York. The Empress of Fashion had endorsed me. I had proven to her I had assignments and challenges she gave me for certain installations in her shows, and I had proven to her my worth. I never feared anything. I never doubted myself once. I am a deeply insecure person for many reasons. I never showed my insecurity. I just rose to the occasion. I stood up straight and tall, like a tall, tall sunflower, and I just radiated the light and the beauty of my mind in relationship to the world of fashion.
So one of your contributions in terms of personal style to fashion is your capes and your caftans. Mm-hmm. How did you start wearing them? And I should say, these are not ordinary capes. These are like amazingly designed, like sometimes out of fur.
Articulated fur and just thought out and processed with the great class, world-class designers. Well, when I went to Marrakesh and saw that the men in North Africa, in Marrakesh and Casablanca, walked around in caftan shirts and loose clip-fitting clothes all day, every day. They had caftans, and this is the indigenous dress of the black man in Marrakesh. And this is, I decided I want to be like that. I want to wear that instead of a suit because it's comfortable. You're ventilated. You're roomy. You're cozy. And you can just stretch. And I'm not a tall stick anymore. I'm a big, big guy of great girth. And it, people think I look like, maybe my clothes don't look that important, but I have taken great time and fittings for my capes and caftans made by the great designers. So I will continue to wear these things to the rest of my life.
Did your weight have anything to do with wanting to wear capes?
Absolutely. Absolutely. My weight issue is an ongoing thing. It's an ongoing battle. I battled it. I battled the bulge of the biscuits, 540 calories, at the Duke Diet and Fitness Center. I go there ever often, almost every other year. It's a place where I go, and it's disciplined. But I've had weight issues, and of course my weight issues are obviously go back to my childhood and the loss of love, and I associate food with love from my grandmother's home, the modest home in the kitchen. My grandmother used to make me a pan of biscuits every Sunday morning just for myself. And you don't know how wonderful that smell is of those hot biscuits with butter and molasses. I have carried that throughout my life. She would make lemon pound cakes. At Christmas, we have fruit cakes, chocolate cake, coconut cake, lemon pound cake, 4 or 5 cakes, 6 pies, sitting, waiting to be eaten on Christmas Day for the family.
But you were skinny as a young man, so something changed.
Something changed when my grandmother died. It was when my grandmother died, I started eating for love, and I just don't know how to discipline it. I'm sorry. Everyone in America is perhaps overweight, and I totally emphasize what people emphasize. I feel very bad, but I did select caftans at a certain age, and my suits, my beautiful custom-made suits, are put away because the caftans create a stately, tall image. You can look great in them and look slim.
So one of the things you mention in the new documentary about you is that you've never had a long-term romantic partner and that you were, you know, very preoccupied with your profession and loved your profession very much. Have you reflected a lot on why you think you never went in that direction?
Every day I reflect upon that. Yeah. I reflect upon. Well, I was as Jonathan Berg, who's a dear friend of mine, said, I was afraid to fall in love. I was afraid of the rejection. I was afraid of emotional commitment, and I was not deliberately making the navigating through the shores and chiffon trenches of my career. It just wasn't a part of me, because although I lived in a world of great promiscuity and libertine ways in the 70s, Studio 54, Paris, and I discovered the freedom of people embracing people for their individuality, or not just their sexuality, that you could be gay, you could be quadrosexual or pansexual, as Janelle Monáe says. I just loved living the life that I lived, living through the world that I was exposed to on the front row from fashion and bonding with people that I could have conversations with. As you remember, I was living a life of an only child in a home with my grandmother. So we didn't have many conversations. I didn't have much to say to my grandmother. She only read The Missionary Helper, her Bible, and the newspapers. And she didn't have a cookbook. She never cooked for a recipe written. All her recipes were in her head. She grew the most beautiful geraniums. She had rows and rows of clay pots with geraniums every year on the porch. Roses in her rose garden. Everything was done by instinct or rote. So I didn't have much to say to my grandmother, and I was very quiet. And so I didn't have people to talk to. I was very much alone in my childhood, except for Vogue. And Vogue was a world, it was like Alice in Wonderland almost. I'd just gone down the rabbit hole into this world of glamour through the pages of writing, the spoken, written word. The word mattered as much as image.
How does that relate to not having a partner?
I was emotionally afraid of people, so I did not want to get close to people. I did not want people to touch me. I didn't like to touch people. So that is just a part of who I am. And I regret to this day, I have difficulty responding to physical emotion. And it's based on, I guess, a childhood experience. I don't know what it is. I can't relate to that. I can't think about that now. But I do regret not having that relationship, and I think about it almost every day because as I get older, it's very, very lonely. I have lived a lonely life. I live in my own gold-plated hell. As Tennessee Williams says, I know the gold-plated hell I'm going to. And I invented this gold-plated hell, and now I must live in it. I have a beautiful home. I have beautiful books, beautiful furniture, beautiful art, beautiful music. I love movies. I have beautiful clothes, but I live in a gold-plated hell. However, I am not going to say it's the worst life. It's been a wonderful life.
When your grandmother died in 1989, did she have a clue how successful you'd become?
Oh, she was very proud of me. She was very, indeed very proud, very proud. She had a great clue. She knew I was on the top of the world at Vogue. She was very proud.
Did you dress her at all?
Oh, yeah, of course I did.
What were good grandmother clothes for her?
Well, good grandmother clothes were not necessarily clothes, they were accessories. And in the summer, I would go to Garfinkel's when I was a park ranger at the Lincoln Memorial and a park ranger at the Fort Washington. And I would go spend all my money on gloves, kids' cloth, leather gloves for my grandmother to wear to church, black leather gloves. And I'd buy her beautiful Kore handbags, K-O-R-E-T. And then I would buy her sometimes shoes. But I was not big on shoes because I bought a pair of the very expensive alligator shoes once on a very high heel, a thick high heel. And I remember she did not wear them much, and she didn't want to hurt my feelings. She just didn't wear them much, and I realized that I made the bad choice because the heels were too high. But she loved all the things that I bought. I bought beautiful hats, and Karl Lagerfeld used to give me beautiful fabric from his collections at Chloe, and I would take the fabric home, and she'd have beautiful dresses made, and those dresses are still in my closet. And then finally, when I got to be big at Vogue, I would buy Chanel suits from the ready-to-wear and give them to my grandmother to wear to church. And she loved them, and she was very proud. A navy blue suit and a pink suit.
All right. It's been a pleasure to talk with you. Thank you so much.
Well, Terry, it's been a great pleasure talking with you. Thank you so much.
Andre Leon Talley is the subject of the new documentary, The Gospel According to Andre. Fresh Air Weekend is produced by Teresa Madden. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our technical director and engineer is Audrey Bentham. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Roberta Shurrock, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, Heidi Simon, Mooj Zaidi, Thea Chaloner, and Seth Kelly. Molly C.V. Nesper is our associate producer of digital media. I'm Terry Gross.